Hello, my name is Joe Schwartz, and I would like to take a moment to tell you about my podcast. It's called Still Unknown, and it's a podcast dealing exclusively with unsolved murders, disappearances, unexplained deaths, and other unsolved mysteries. If you are a fan of the classic TV show Unsolved Mysteries, then you'll definitely want to check out my podcast, as many episodes deal with cases featured on the show that still need answers. So look for Still Unknown on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you are listening to this podcast here. And let's solve some mysteries together.
Welcome to Forensic Miles. My name is Miles.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Sean.
Forensic Miles is the unofficial companion podcast to the cult favorite show, Forensic Files. You've seen the show, you know the crime, but is there more to the story? Let's find out. This week, we actually have a special guest, my brother, Nico.
Hey, guys.
And we are going to be covering a very interesting case called A Squire's Riches. So, you want to just hop right in?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. In 2008, Ari Squire had everything going for him. At least that's what it looked like from the outside. He had a successful construction business, a large house in a Chicago suburb, a wife, and he was able to indulge in his favorite pastime, truck pulls. If you don't know what that is, do you know what that is?
Isn't it when you get a bunch of souped up trucks and you pull tractors behind you and try to get the fastest time or something along that.
That's basically what it is. I didn't know. So I had to look it up. It's basically big trucks pulling even bigger loads, and whoever pulls the heaviest load, the fastest speed, is the winner. It requires a good amount of skill, and you have to be a pretty good mechanic to have this as one of your hobbies. And Ari was. But much like a lot of the other tractor pull enthusiasts, this wasn't just a hobby for Ari, it was more of an obsession. Because of his thriving business, Ari was able to add a 2,300 square foot garage addition to his Chicago suburb home. That's a pretty big garage.
It's like 2.5 of our homes.
I would love that if that was in my garage and I was doing track pulls. That'd be awesome.
Exactly. This gave him room to tinker and modify his truck, and it was pretty much a dream. Unfortunately, this dream garage would ultimately turn into Ari's worst nightmare. On February 23rd, 2008, a 911 call was made reporting a fire in the garage. The call was made by Ari's wife, Denise Squire. The call is, in my opinion, kind of strange. You hear a short clip of it on the Forensic Files episode, and Denise is kind of, I don't know, not really that worried.
At all.
No.
You'd think she'd be more frantic with her 2,300 square foot garage on fire that they just built.
Exactly. She basically says something like, "Hey, I think my garage is on fire. Should I leave the house or should I just stay in the house?" And the 911 operator's like, "Yeah, you should definitely leave the house."
I don't know why she was even still in the house.
Yeah, the fact that she even asked, saying, "Should I leave the house?" is automatically like, something's going on here.
Exactly. I definitely think it would be obvious that if your house is on fire, you would leave. But I don't know. I only bring it up because I do think that this is relevant for the story, and we'll get to that later on. When the fire department arrived on scene, Denise was waiting outside. She said she was concerned about her husband since he wasn't answering his phone. When they finally were able to put the fire out, they found a horrible scene. Pinned underneath a truck was the charred body of Ari Squire. Investigators believed that a bizarre sequence of events led to this deadly fire. They theorized that Ari was under the truck in it somehow slipped off the jack, crushing him to death while he was working on the fuel filter, meaning that the fuel spilled all over his clothing. Not only did the truck crush Ari, though, it also crushed a fluorescent lamp that was on the floor. When the lamp was crushed, a spark was released, which ignited the fire. It sounds like a game of mousetrap.
Almost, yeah.
Almost like...
almost too good to be true.
Exactly.
It's like a freak of nature, almost.
Exactly. Like, you know, all of these things had to be set up in just a certain way for it to play out the way that it did. Ari's death was shocking to his friends, especially those in the diesel trucking world. Although they were surprised that Ari hadn't been using any safety measures, which he normally would have, the death was a familiar manner. You know, the whole community spent most of their time underneath their trucks, and for a truck to crush one of their friends wasn't unheard of or even abnormal.
Doesn't take much to, I mean, it's going to crush you instantly.
Exactly. Unfortunately, the burns left his body unrecognizable, and they were only able to identify Ari based on his clothing and his driver's license, which was found on his body. Like I said, from the outside, Ari seemed to have it all. But when investigators started to look a little deeper into his life, they realized that maybe, just maybe, things weren't exactly as they appeared to be. The squire's marriage was essentially loveless. It was cold. The investigator said that they had been married 14 years and there were hardly any photos of them around the house. Only a small wedding picture. Now, I will say, Sean and I don't have a lot of pictures of us around the house. I don't even think we have one. We might have one.
I don't think so.
We at least have one picture.
I guess we have one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little hurt that I got no photos in this house, I say.
Okay, well, we just moved in
a year ago. That's true. That is very true.
Okay, moving right along. He said that their marriage seemed more of a transaction, that they both led separate lives and really didn't know anything about each other. I think one of the investigators even said or asked Denise, like, hey, where was Ari yesterday? What was he doing? And she legitimately had no idea what he was doing. That wasn't all, though. In December 2007, Ari was sentenced to 5 years probation and 6 months home confinement, in addition to $63,000 in restitution for bilking Medicare. So I didn't know what bilking was, and I looked it up, and it is to obtain or withhold money from someone by deceit or without justification, cheat, or defraud. So,
bad stuff.
Yeah, it wasn't great. His court bills, in addition to the end of the housing boom, left Ari and his business practically bankrupt. Ari also had a life insurance policy for $5 million, and this life insurance policy's premium was about to go up.
Yeah, I think in the Forensic Files episode, they mentioned that the premium was $2,000, and based on his age, it was going to be going up to $13,000.
Yeah, and that's just not something that Ari could afford right then. He could hardly afford what he was paying before. And there
must not have been a good policy.
I guess not.
I would have given him one better.
But there was only one beneficiary for this insurance policy, and it was his wife, Denise. When the investigator told Denise that her worst worries about her husband's safety were in fact warranted and that he had passed away in the fire, her reaction was not weird, but notable. The investigator believed she was in sensory overload, a perfectly normal reaction to a trauma like this. But after he told her, her response was only, quote, what do I do now? She didn't cry. She didn't really ask any questions. She just wanted to know what her next step was.
She wanted to have his body cremated already.
Exactly.
Yeah, she was making on the episode, it said that she was making in lots of calls saying, where's the body? Can I get the body so I can cremate it?
Exactly. She definitely wanted things to be pushed along. Denise quickly organized a memorial where over 100 friends, family members, and acquaintances came to pay their respects to Ari. Many guests wrote in an online condolence book, sending their love and memories. One person wrote that Ari was, quote, the most kind, spirited, giving person ever. End quote. But there were some uninvited guests, members of the police department. They had good reason. They were following their gut, and something just felt off about this case. Upon further investigation of the garage, they found some interesting inconsistencies. When a truck falls off a jack, it's typical that there will be some kind of dents, scratches, or some sort of damage. But in this case, there was none. Another inconsistency was with the fluorescent lamp. It was assumed that this was the cause of the fire. But upon further investigation, it was discovered that the circuit breaker was off, meaning that there was no electricity going to the lamp, which would mean that there was no possible way the lamp could have been the cause of the fire.
That's a big red flag right there.
Definitely a big red flag. And then there was the fuel. It was discovered that there was a lot more fuel on the victim's clothes than could have been held in the fuel tank. What's more, some of the fuel wasn't even the right kind of fuel that would have been in the fuel tank. They were never able to identify this fuel, but it was known that it was much more flammable than what would have come from the truck. So there was more, and there were two kinds.
It was a mixture of.
Exactly. Which caused the fire to be a lot stronger than it would have been had it just been the fuel from the tank.
One could say he was trying to destroy the evidence.
Exactly. But what people don't realize is fires don't just destroy evidence, they create more. With all of these inconsistencies, the case was looked at more and more like a homicide than just an accident. The medical examiner realized that it might not be a bad idea to be really 100% sure that the victim was in fact Ari Squire. Because the body was so charred, they weren't able to do fingerprint identification or obviously facial identification. This left them with two options, DNA or dental identification. Now, usually we don't agree with dental identification, or we don't agree with bite marks. But when it comes to dental and x-rays, I think it's a different situation. Ari hadn't been to the dentist in almost a decade, so it did take them a little while to track down his records, but when they finally did, they were faced with a new problem. Ari had a large filling in one of his molars. X-rays from the victim showed that they did not have this filling. Denise also told investigators that Ari had a tattoo on his upper arm. There was no tattoo on the victim's body.
How could that be?
It definitely left a lot of questions. And by Monday, Denise was already asking for Ari's remains for cremation. This all leads to the next question. If it wasn't Ari, who was the victim, and where in the world was Ari? On February 25th, 2008, Donna Fiorito called police to report her son missing. Justin Newman was a 20-year-old, hardworking kid. He worked at Home Depot and was last seen February 23rd. On February 24th, Donna received a strange text from him. The text said, "Gone to MO for work. Call you next week." So by MO, he's saying Missouri. But there were a couple strange things about the text. First of all, Donna said that Justin wouldn't have known that MO means Missouri, and he would have never written MO. And he would have never texted her in the first place. She said that he wasn't a texter, and if he wanted to talk to her, he would have just called her. So the text definitely was strange and was kind of the final straw in her realizing that something was wrong. Obviously, she knew that something was a little bit off when he didn't come home on Saturday, but this was really what pushed it over the edge.
Also, the fact that they lived together and he went to go to work, and why would he just suddenly get up to go away for a week and not pack anything?
Exactly. But I think her initial thought was what I'm about to get right into, because Justin had just been offered a new job. Donna told investigators that Justin had been approached by a man at Home Depot. He basically walked right up to Justin and said, "Hey, you look like a hard worker. Would you like to make some extra money?" Justin was helping support his mother, so they all lived together in a small apartment, and it was really his goal to try and afford a bigger apartment to provide for his mother and his family. And this man offered him $15 an hour to help him at his home. And this seemed like too good to be true. I mean, this was absolutely a dream. He was telling his mom that he was going to buy her a Lamborghini. Like, he was excited. He was doing this for his family and, you know, this was the perfect situation for him. Justin was scheduled to meet this man on Saturday, February 23rd at the man's home. And what was this man's name, you ask? Ask me.
What was his name, Oz?
Ari Squire.
Oh my God!
Mm-hmm. The medical examiner decided to re-examine the body. They noticed that Justin and Ari were essentially the same height and weight, 5'6" and about 140 pounds. They took DNA samples from Justin's toothbrush as well as his mother and compared it to the remains. It was a match. They were finally able to identify the body as Justin Newman. Police issued an all-points bulletin for Justin's car. They believed if they could find the car, they would find Ari. That's when police received a very interesting tip. A man named Sandy Lively. Sandy also worked at Home Depot with Justin. And he said that Ari often hung around Home Depot and would talk to him a lot. In fact, he said that Ari would constantly badger him about coming to work for him at his home. Sandy finally gave in and was given an insanely detailed job application to fill out. The application was nothing like Sandy had ever seen before. It asked about tattoos, where his tattoos were, if he had piercings, where the piercings were, stuff like that.
Especially for like a construction job.
Yeah.
It's just weird.
Yeah, Sandy was confused. He said in one of the episodes that I watched, how would me having a tattoo affect my ability to do construction work?
Yeah.
It didn't make any sense to him, but he filled it out and he ended up scheduling a time to meet. Sandy's first scheduled day of work was Saturday, February 23rd. Luckily for Sandy, though, his daughter had had her 10th birthday party on Friday, February 22nd. It was a sleepover with a bunch of 10-year-old girls, and he ended up being kept up all night.
Sounds like my worst nightmare.
Just get ready. He slept through his alarm and ended up missing the appointment. When having the conversation with police, the police noticed something interesting. Sandy and Ari looked very, very similar. In fact, Ari seemed to have been trying to make himself look even more like Sandy. And in the weeks before the fire, he grew out his beard. When he did this, the two could have looked like twins. And I'll add a picture to the Instagram, but they look like doppelgangers. Like, they look like the same person.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Sandy was suddenly faced with the realization that Ari had had his eye on him, and he was most likely Ari's victim of choice. Investigators believed that when Sandy missed the appointment, Ari was frustrated and called Justin, his second choice. When Justin arrived at his home, investigators believed that Ari used chloroform to control him. He then took off all of Justin's clothes and switched them with his own, as well as switching their wallets. He then put Justin under the truck, lifted up the jack, and then let it fall, crushing Justin to death. They definitely believe that Justin was dead before the fire started.
I mean, yeah, it's like a 5-ton truck.
Yeah.
Semi-truck.
Yeah, no. This leaves us with one big question. Where was Ari? Within a few days, an officer was doing a routine license check. He said that they do it a lot at local motels. Like, they'll drive around and they'll run the license plate of these cars that are parked in motels. He ended up running the license plate of Justin's car and realized that, you know, people were looking for it. The officer ended up going into the motel and asking which guest the car belonged to. The office worker said that the car belonged to a man named Justin Newman. Ding, ding, ding. Obviously, not
impossible.
Justin. The officer decided to confront Ari without backup. He walked to the motel room and knocked on the door, identifying himself as a police officer. Within seconds, he heard one single gunshot. It turns out Ari had killed himself. Ari had assumed Justin's identity and had even gone so far as to dye his hair and wear blue contacts to look even more like him.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Ari knew what his future would hold. He was headed to prison for a long, long time, and he couldn't face it. I think in the Forensic Files episode, one of the investigators calls him a coward. He knows what he's in for, and he's just not man enough to face it. This time, when officers went to tell Denise that her husband was dead, her reaction was very, very different. She genuinely was surprised that he had killed himself, and she even started crying. She admitted that she had actually been in communication with Ari in the days he was supposedly dead. He sent her some strange emails asking about the memorial, when and where she was going to spread his ashes, as well as telling her where his final will was. Initially, she said that she thought the emails were automatically scheduled. I don't believe this at all.
Yeah, no way.
Based on the way she reacted on the 911 call, and after the first time she was told that her husband was dead, she knew that her husband was alive and well. Like, I think that she had to say that she was in the house and ask whether or not she should leave, because to show that she wouldn't have done it herself, maybe, because she was in the house, she wouldn't have set the fire to her own house. And I think a lot of people also say that it says a lot about Ari that he started the fire with her in the home. But maybe she wasn't in the home.
Yeah, she
might not have even been in the home.
Yeah.
Either way, it's my personal opinion that she had to know, and I'm going to get a little bit more into that. Supposedly, Ari's life insurance premium was about to go up, which is what we said. And they came to this plan in order to cash out and ride off into the sunset with his $5 million.
Yeah, because Ari's not going to see the money. So he has to have somebody else in on it. Otherwise,
there's no one to accept the money.
Yeah. Well, it would go to Denise, but Ari still wants the money.
Exactly. Denise denied that she had anything to do with the murder of Justin. And like you said, she had to have known because they needed somebody to claim the money in order for the plot to play out.
And if I got emails from somebody that was supposedly dead, even if I thought they were a scheduled email, I would be like, hey, either the murderer is out there or my husband's still out there somewhere and like on the run from something.
Okay, but P.S. I Love You was a really romantic movie, and she got letters for months after her husband died.
Yeah, I don't know.
But yes, exactly.
I would be skeptical.
I think that she absolutely knew.
Unless I were in on it.
And she was responding to these emails. She was responding to them in a conversational sort of a way.
Yeah, why would you respond to them if you know it's just going to go to a...
Nothingness.
Yeah, no one's going to ever read it.
Or,
why would you take the time to respond?
Yeah,
I don't even respond half the time to emails that I know people
are
waiting for.
I won't even respond. I got a lot of emails, too.
Although Denise was never formally charged for the crime, suspicion has always surrounded her, and investigators have always been determined to convict her. At the time that the Dateline episode was released in 2009, the insurance company had not paid out the life insurance to Denise. However, since Ari killed himself in the two-year window between when the suicide clause would no longer be effective, she was eligible to collect the money from his life insurance policy. So either way, Denise got the money. She also was able to collect insurance money from the garage fire and ended up getting $14,000, which basically covered all of the repairs of that for the garage.
And when did she get paid out?
I'm not really sure.
Well, the insurance company would have sued her for it after they found out about...
No, she got the money. In 2009, she still lived in that home. She never moved out. Donna ended up filing a civil lawsuit against Ari and Denise, and she ended up winning. The jury awarded her $6 million. Donna said of losing her son, quote, "I've never heard of anything happening like this to anyone in my life, ever. It's inexcusable for anybody. anybody to do this to another human being, he had to be some kind of monster, very heinous. And it's all about money. I'm never going to be over it. I'm going to live my every day of my life thinking about Justin, end quote. Sandy says he too lives every day of his life thinking about Justin. If not a couple hours a day, it's all day long. This case will haunt him his whole life.
Anyone, if that were to happen to anyone, I feel that would be the same reaction, because that's had to be a very scary, situation to be in.
Realization.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Knowing that you could have lost your life to this guy.
Yeah.
I feel like I would have, permanent paranoia after finding out, that long con that he was doing to,
look like him,
kill me and take over my identity. Yeah. I'd probably be paranoid for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And we also have to remember that he knew Justin. I mean, Justin was his coworker. He was that kid that was, working with him, that was nice and kind and genuine to everybody that he met. So it was kind of a double hit for Sandy. He says that he suffers survivor's guilt and he struggles with nightmares. He said that his dreams, when he dreams that he's under the truck and he's not dead and he can see Ari lighting the fire, but there's nothing he can do about it. So, wow. I mean,
that's crazy.
To live your life having that dream over and over again.
Yeah.
It's just terrible. There's one last little tidbit that I wanted to cover. Supposedly, both Ari and the investigator on this case were inspired by a particular Forensic Files episode. This case was the case of Madison Rutherford, and I'm not going to get into it that much because we're eventually going to cover the case, but it's essentially the same thing. It's about a man who fakes his own death to claim an insurance policy and then disappear with a new identity. And there are a lot of similarities in this case. Madison had about $6,000 worth of life insurance money. There was a fire on a car and a dead body in a car and a new identity. It seems very similar. And it said that Ari had seen this episode and that he was inspired, this has inspired his plot. And the investigator had also watched this episode while actively on a case, on this case, and realized, hey.
So, a lot of similarities.
Maybe Ari isn't dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I thought that was very interesting, and it goes back to our love of Forensic Files. But, that's about all I have for you this week.
I don't know if I would steal a Forensic Files episode because, you got to assume it's going to be a similar outcome.
Yep. He would. He would think that. But, not everybody's as smart as us.
I guess so.
All right. Well, we will be back with you next week. Nico might be there again.
Yeah. We'll see.
We'll see.
Hopefully.
But we hope that you enjoyed this episode today, and we'll talk to you next week.
Catch you guys on the flip side.
Bye.
Later.